Dublin.
Welcome everyone to Studio Soundtracks, the monthly program that takes listeners behind the scenes of making music for film and television. I'm your host, Chandler Poling. My guests today are some of the most fascinating composers working today. They create unique soundscapes with their work with a distinct audio signature. They also have some very long names. Let's see if I get this right. Welcome to the show, Robert Ikey Aubrey Lowe and Emile Levenez Farouche. How did I do, guys?
Pretty good.
Almost.
You stumble on the easiest one and you did the hard one really, really well. It's Emily.
Emily.
Yeah. You got the last name. You got like the super long one, like spot on.
Oh my, I can't, I must have been nervous. I just, you know, you look at these names and you're like, oh my goodness, these are quite yeah. These distinct artistic names. I better get them right. And then of course I just stumble on Emily. Anyways, welcome to the show, both of you. I'm very excited to be talking with you here on Studio Soundtracks. We've entered the month of October, and what a better pair to have than the two of you who have created some very distinct scores in horror films. We have the recent remake of Candyman and the Sundance feature film Censor. The question I really want to start out is, did you two set out to work in film from the beginning, or did these opportunities come to you later in your kind of musician careers? And let's start with Robert.
Okay. No, I have a real love for cinema. I have since I was very young. And I definitely think that the work that I've done over the years has a sort of kinship to cinematic landscapes, but I never necessarily sought out to be a film composer necessarily. It's something that came naturally over time.
And Emily?
I also really loved cinema growing up, but I think for me, it all came together when I started studying at university because there was film students and they were making short films. And I finally kind of realized that I could potentially make the music for those short films. So after that, it started becoming something I was really, really interested in doing. But I never really wanted to have a musical practice that was only film scores, if you know what I mean. I kind of wanted to be part of a wider exploration of music, even though, you know, I completely respect people who only do film scores, but I just mm-hmm. wanted to have something slightly more, have areas where I could just do whatever I wanted without necessarily having to work with visual elements.
Now, earlier we were discussing how you two have not had the chance to meet yet, but you're both familiar with each other's work. So Robert, how did you become familiar with Emily's work? And Emily, where did you hear Robert's work first?
Who first?
Let's start with you, Robert.
Okay. I had been familiar with Emily's name for a few years and sort of checked in here and there, but it was when I saw an announcement for the film Censor that I was really very curious about what the sonic landscape of that film was like. And became very excited once I was able to hear the score due to the fact that I have a real love for video nasties, you know, or what would have been considered slasher films in the 1980s, because that's the era I grew up in. And I was familiar with a lot of those types of films. And also the scores that you would find in films like that. And so I was very curious to see what it was. And then I was able to hear Emily's score and was very excited about it. I thought it was very, very well done.
And I was aware of Robert as like a collaborator, because you've worked with so many people. So your name kind of popped up on so many various projects, but I didn't know you were making film scores. And then when I, obviously, as soon as I heard that there was a Candyman, you know, new film, when the soundtrack was out, I immediately listened to it. And it was, I think for me, what was really striking is without like knowing each other or anything, there are some elements in both score, especially the idea of like vocal layering. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was so interesting that like across the world, without not talking to one another, we had this kind of same idea in terms of expressing the lead characters, I expect, mm-hmm. in a world. And I was just like, wow, this is amazing. Like this kind of parallel path was just very exciting.
Yeah, no, I think that's something that was really nice for me when I listened to your score and hearing these elements that definitely found a crossover. There was almost sort of I feel like there are these events that happen where you have this sort of consciousness that sort of lays over the landscape and sort of synchronicity that happens in these artistic forms. And I was very excited about that.
Yeah, we will get into the vocal layering because I have some questions about that, actually, because I noticed that when listening to both of your scores that you have this kind of unique element to it. But I was curious, with the genre of horror, do you feel that that gives you more room for experimentation in your music? Is there something about horror that really, like, are the filmmakers more open to it? Does the genre call for it? Emily, you're nodding your head. Let's hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, I was thinking about it recently, and I think horror as a genre, because it is supposed, part of the appeal of it is to trigger a response of fear in a safe environment. And the thing that scares us the most is the unknown. So I think the horror audience craves seeing things they've never seen before, hearing things they've never seen before. And that makes it an area that's very fertile for experimentation, because that's exactly what the people watching horror wants. They don't want familiarity. They don't want the same old things. So I think if you're really looking to push yourself a little further, it's just the perfect genre.
Robert, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think I would agree with that. I would say, for me, I think that there are those possibilities within any type of film, with any type of storytelling. It has to do with how open all parties are involved with sort of pushing the boundaries of what's been established. I do think that there is a little more leeway in the realm of horror films, due to the sort of visceral nature of the emotional responses you get from this concept of fear or dread. But you know, and I think that there are also ways to play around with sort of whimsy inside of that as well. So it doesn't all have to be dire and dark. It can be a little playful as also. But yeah, I do think that the genre itself lends to a little more openness in that regard.
What's an example of a score in horror that really stands out to you? Is there something that you've seen recently or even as far back as Bernard Herrmann? Is there a score that you think really stood out to you as challenging what we are used to hearing in film scoring and really scaring you?
Emily, I'll let you take this one first.
I don't know if it's a score per se, but I think the sound in Texas Chainsaw Massacre really marked me because it uses, rusty sound and sounds of like metals and like really screechy sounds. And I think that was, yeah, that really impressed me and that really stayed with me for a very, very long time. That's got the whole, I just love that film, but I thought the way it uses sound is just very, very exciting and influential.
I would agree with that. It's an excellent film, and also one that I think is maybe a little misunderstood because it works on so many levels. It is a landscape film. It is a road movie. It is a psychological thriller of sorts. It deals with the subject matter is really packed into that film. And also visually, I think it's a pretty stunning film. But I would say for me, and getting back to this idea of whimsical and playful, the Wicker Man score by Paul Giovanni for me is probably the one that stands out due to the fact that it was dealing with. There were no real typical horror elements in that score. It dealt with more folk music and traditional music, and the way that that was implemented in that story really fed into that terror. So I would say Paul Giovanni's Wicker Man for me would be the one.
Very cool. At the top of the show, we heard the track Graffiti from Candyman by Robert. And I read somewhere that you took a lot of field recordings from the film locations and incorporated it into the score. Was that an example of that process in that track, or can you tell us a bit more about the approach in that one in terms of Candyman?
So in that particular track, there is a little bit, you do hear a little bit of the field recording, but a lot of what you're hearing is manipulation of delay feedback, actually. A lot of that, the sort of low guttural sounds, is just me playing around with using a delay and having it feedback on itself and sort of using control voltage inside of a modular synthesizer to manipulate how that moved. And it does so in a very organic way. And the interesting thing about that particular piece is it probably, I think, with a lot of the sound that you hear in Candyman, I think there's going to be a little bit of confusion as to what is the sound design or the sound effects and what is the score. I really wanted to be able to sort of build a complete world sonically that was able to produce a narrative inside of the narrative that you were hearing through the dialogue and the visual. And a lot of the elements that you hear in the film that most people would consider to be sound design, they are sort of musical sound design, if you will, or non-diegetic sound design. So the diegetic sound I didn't deal with at all. There are a couple moments where you do hear insects buzzing that were from field recordings that I did on location. But for the most part, any of the diegetic sound was done by the sound mixer and sound designer, Michael Babcock. But what I think most people are hearing in the film that they might consider to be sound design are these weird, strange sounds that sort of live underneath the dialogue throughout the scenes. That's actually work that I created while building this world of sound and really creating the vocabulary over many months of going back and forth with Nia DaCosta, the director, and really talking about what it all meant and how to convey a feeling without imposing a bias. I really wanted to stay away from this idea of creating an emotional bias with the film score, because I think that's where film scores can fail in a way. And so I wanted to make sure to stay as neutral as possible, but also to be able to provide a feeling there.
Emily, as far as terms of field recordings or kind of manipulation of tapes or whatever, is there a practice that you use that you feel pushes yourself outside your comfort zone?
On the specific score?
In general, but on sensor, I'm curious as well.
I think it's the first time I actually use my voice on anything. But I don't know when I was... I think it's just the concept of grieving is something I've been looking into over the past 3 years, which is also, you know, for my solo work. But then when the script came through, just for me, like, what really attracted me to Enid is the fact that she's someone still grieving and the kind of shame that's often linked with grief. And at the time in my research, and I was looking at mourning across the world, and I'd seen a Terence Simon piece, An Occupation of Loss, the year before. And I'd been listening to a lot of recording of grieving rituals, basically. And I think when I was starting thinking about that score, I just kind of took a microphone and started, just projecting this idea of grieving into the mic. And then just manipulating it until it's, the vast majority of people assume it's all synth, but a lot of it is my voice, but treated. So for me, that was like the big push, because I'd never made my voice the kind of center instrument of anything. But it just felt completely appropriate for this character as well, that it wasn't a professional singer, and it wasn't like necessarily big themes, but more someone just humming themselves to sleep, or trying to pacify themselves with little little songs, little bits of lullaby like that. So yeah, I think that was the bigger, and it's really scary when you've never really used your voice in anything, and then you're in a cinema and you have to like hear it very loud. But yeah, I'm really happy I did that.
Yeah, the result was fantastic. So I will play a track from Sensor. This is the main title theme from the film by Emily. thank you so much for bringing that track in. It gave me a lot of Goblin vibes. I don't know if you're familiar with their work from Suspiria, but was that like a temp, or is that something that you were just were excited about or inspired by? Where did you kind of land on that kind of twinkly vibe?
There was hardly any temp in the film when I came on board, but yeah, the score for Suspiria by Goblin is a long time favorite of mine. I've been going back to it over and over again. There's another, I don't know if you know The Daughters of Darkness, which is a François de Roubaix score where he has like a cymbalum as well, so like other kind of plucked instrument. So that sonority was definitely something I was gonna go for, and I had a Suzuki Taisho Goto, so it's like a Japanese instrument, but it's like a DI. You can just plug it straight into the, you don't have to mic it or anything. So I had that in my studio, so obviously I'd been waiting for an occasion to use it, and Sansa was just like the perfect score to reference this kind of plucked string instrument that you would have in giallos and 70s, very aesthetically pleasing horror films.
Amazing. And of course, we heard voice in that track as well. And earlier, we talked about use of voice in Robert's score on Candyman as well. Can you two just kind of discuss the process that goes into it? I know you spoke a little bit earlier about that, Emily. So Robert, why don't you talk a little bit about your use of voice and how you actually process that into the score?
Well, so voice has been my primary instrument for many years. I've known for the vocal work that I do for quite a long time. And it came about because I arrived at a point where I wanted to really focus on the voice as an instrument and really push the boundaries of my own voice and see what I was able to create. Through movement, through posture, where from the body I sang from. And so for many years, I would sort of cultivated this technique of creating these choirs of voices by looping my voice and singing in different registers and in different ways to create these clusters of sound with the voice, to also remove it from the realm of the voice as a human voice and to be able to create sound with my body that wouldn't necessarily register as a human voice. And so due to that fact and due to the fact that Nia and I had many conversations about this sort of concept of the multiplicity of voices within the story arc of the film, dealing with folklore, dealing with apparitions. I wanted to be able to create these sort of very distinct landscapes inside of the score in which you had this sort of uneasy movement of voices throughout. And for the most part, the majority of the voice in the score is my own. There are a couple different compositions in which I engaged a close friend and collaborator of mine, Hildur Gudnadottir. She and I have collaborated for years, and we've sung together many times, and I knew that our voices were paired. And she could act in certain ways as a counterpoint to my own voice. And so I wanted to also utilize her voice in the score to give it even more depth. But there are moments where people, you know that she performed on the score, and there are moments where people assume that it's her voice because they think it's a woman's voice and it's actually my voice. And so I also like to play with this concept of illusion. In which you don't know exactly what the sound is or where the sound comes from. That was something that was really important to me. Also, dealing with the concept of the film, which deals with mirrors and reflections, and how those sounds are reflected within the scope of the film.
That's amazing. I love hearing about this process. Do you guys have any tips for listeners that may be wanting to use voice in a score or in a track and something that they're using that that you think that would be of beneficial or of use?
I guess I would say just explore your voice. The human voice is the most unique instrument that we have available to us. And it's very individual, like every voice is different. And I guess my advice would be to try to think of the voice as an instrument, try to take it outside of how we often think of the voice as a vehicle for language. I think that there are many different ways in which you can use the voice without using words to create narrative spaces and non-linear spaces, really sort of move outside of how we conceive of the voice and how we use the voice from day to day.
Anything from you, Emily?
I don't have the same amount of experience as Robert. I think most of what he said, but just have fun. If you're just starting out, don't necessarily try to, achieve something that you already have in mind. Just play around with things. Even like add effects if you're uncomfortable listening to your own naked voice, but just push it to a few like weird reverbs, weird echoes, weird effects, so that you just learn to appreciate how malleable it is in terms of, you know, how flexible it is, how you can tune it, and yeah, just have fun for a little bit of time, and then you'll be more comfortable with it. But it is scary at first to have to like listen to your own voice back. It just takes a bit of time to get used to it.
Excellent. Another great example of voice that I'm currently hearing in a score is the television show Why the Last Man by Erdős Stefán Dottir. And there's all this kind of use of voice and mumbling and murmuring and making this kind of inaudible thing that is really standing out. But speaking of voice, I want to play a track from Candyman that you definitely hear the use of voice. This is the track called Leaves a Stain. Thank you. I want to talk a bit about live performance. You're both experienced with performing your own music. Do you enjoy this experience, or do you more enjoy the comfort of your studio and creating the kind of content in your own space? Emily, we'll start with you.
It's a completely different experience because I've mostly performed alone on stage. I've had occasions to work with other people, which I like. It makes it a lot less scarier because you have each other's back. There's communication. There's a shared experience on stage, but it can be really incredible, depending on how the audience is responding. If you can feel the kind of energy back, it's one of the stronger feeling on the planet. But yeah, I find it a little bit more challenging than just to be able to get lost in my head for days on end without talking to any other person. And just so both of them can be really incredible, but if I'm honest, I'm probably more comfortable hidden away in the studio.
Robert, do you have any thoughts on that?
I would agree that the two are very different, but I really enjoy both. I also have mainly done live performance as a solo artist. But with me, improvisation leans very heavily into my practice. My practice is very aleatoric in the way of me using chance elements in the creation of work. And I do that both in a live setting, in a performance setting, and in a recorded or studio setting. So for me, every time I want it to be as fresh as possible, and I want it to be as exciting as possible for myself. And so having that element of improvisation is something that really gives me an excitement. And yeah, I think it's something where I don't have I don't get nervous with live performance. Something I've done for many, many years. But I think the anticipation of doing that thing, I don't like the idea of hurrying up to wait, you know, getting into a situation where you're going to do a live performance and you do a sound check and then you have to wait. I prefer to just do it. I really enjoy being able to put it out into the world in that way. And due to that fact, you know, being able to put the work out into the world, I'm able to share it, these artistic endeavors, but also once I put it out in the world, it no longer belongs to me. And I think that that's something that's really important. You are able to give over a part of yourself to an audience, and they can do what they will with it. They can react or feel how they will. And that's, of course, not up to me. And I like that. I like the fact that people can, from their own vantage point or their own perspective, take what I've given them and do what they will with it. And then go away with that memory of the thing, of the event that took place.
What would you say is one of the most challenging things about what you do as a composer and a musician?
The most challenging thing? I don't know. That's interesting. I don't know. I enjoy the idea of a challenge. I enjoy the idea of taking on something that I haven't maybe considered before. So I don't know that there is a really big challenge in that way. As an artist, you know, as a multidisciplinary artist, doing many different things in many different ways, I really enjoy being able to conceptualize things and then play around with these ideas and then through this aleatoric process have the possibility of considering new things in the realm of collaboration. I really enjoy the idea that I have to submit in some way to the ideas of others, because I think ultimately that helps you grow in your process and your practice as an artist. So I don't know, yeah, as far as the question of the biggest challenge, I don't know that I would really consider one. It should always be challenging. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I could say necessarily.
No, I do agree with the idea that it should always feel challenging. Being in too comfortable a place when you're making music is not necessarily a good thing in terms of stretching yourself. I think, I don't know if it's a challenge per se, but something that you have to find every time on a film score for me is, and I find really interesting, is understanding, because you can't control how the audience is going to react to your music, but you do have to understand how the director reacts to music to a certain extent. And that I find really fascinating, because it forces you to kind of imagine how, what music means into somebody else's head. And that's, it is a challenge in a sense, because music becomes a very natural language to yourself. And it's like learning a foreign language in a way, or like a slight variation on your own language. And yeah, getting that lexicon of what the director means, how the director feels to react to certain sound, to certain chord progression. I think that is a challenge, because for you, some things are going to sound extremely joyful, and for them, not so much. And that's a really interesting element in collaborating with visual artists and directors, I would say.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. But I think that's where the collaboration really takes shape. You know, this idea of actually having a dialogue and creating a vocabulary with your collaborator, and you're able to really exchange ideas and understand where each other are coming from, and build a stronger work due to that fact. I think you have to be open to that concept of collaboration. I think you have to be ready to give up certain concepts that you may have in order to, you know, film is such a collaborative art form, and it takes so many ideas and so many humans to actually create a film. And due to that fact, you have to understand how you fit into that equation, and how you can actually make your voice heard, and not in any sort of a forceful way, but in a way, like I said, in which to make the work stronger. For me, it makes more sense to really conceptualize and have intention with the work that you're doing, because it inevitably it's there to advance or expand the universe that you are all creating together.
Yeah, it's a strong narrative layer. It's a narrative dimension in the film. And that's what's magical, actually, when you watch a film that you worked on, is it is the accumulation of talent. And a great director is someone who is able to kind of has a general idea of what the picture should look like, and pieces all the pieces of puzzle together to make it happen, and give enough space to everyone to contribute to create
absolutely
a great whole.
Well, I want to play another track of Emily's. This one is titled "You Sick Bee" from Censor.
Oh.
Now, Emily, why did you bring that particular track to the show? What does it mean to you?
It's I think it's one of the one in terms of vocal layering that I'm the happiest with, and it was also one where I was looking at stereo work, stereo panning, which actually I'd love to ask Robert about in terms of, because I found it quite challenging. Because when you're working on music, you can have a lot of fun, well, to a certain extent, but with stereo, but you know, like trems or panning things quite brutally. But so there was a few track where I was playing with that, and that one is one where I was playing with trems quite a lot. But I was interested in finding out more because I read that you were using binaural also on the score, on like an NPR interview, and I was wondering then how did you approach the specificity of 5-1 sound and like surround sound, you know, cinema sound? How did that affect the way you were writing the music? Was it something that was at the back of your mind when you were writing in terms of, you know, how things were going to sound in the cinema, or were you not thinking about it too much while composing?
So I didn't actually use any specifically binaural recording techniques, but one thing that was very important to me was to be able to consider the sound in a surround field. And honestly, most of what I was concentrated on was being able to create psychoacoustic effects in a stereo field, because once you start to get into that realm, you don't really have to go outside of having two speakers involved. I wanted to be able to excite the ear in ways with certain frequencies in which you would feel it in different parts of your body or the back of your neck, and not in a way that was overbearing or would lean into sort of horror tropes. But I wanted to have, utilizing the elementally all of the things that I did to create this electroacoustic score, and to use cello and contrabass and voice and electronics and bowed metal. I wanted to be able to really pick out and carve out frequencies in which you would feel it in different parts of your body, and would add this sort of physical element to the experience. And so working with my co-producer and the engineer, Randall Dunn, we really worked on this concept of spatialization inside of a stereo field, and wanted to focus on that because ultimately I wanted the score to be able to live not only within the landscape of a film, but have its own life as audio outside of the visual, and to be able to really create a narrative that would be understandable as an album. And so due to that fact, yeah, it was a lot of playing with this concept of psychoacoustics and really being able to feel the score in different ways.
Now, Robert, the next track I'm going to play is something called William Chases Brianna, and it's a track that you specifically picked out for the program. So what does this track mean to you?
This track, I really wanted to showcase this particular track because in the film, it's really truncated and sort of buried in the sound mix, and I really wanted to for people to be able to hear everything that's going on. There are a lot of different elements going on, and a lot of it is a lot of the brass sounding elements that sound like trumpets in a room, like in a deep space, are actually most of that is actually contrabass. Some of it is this bowed metal object that I used a lot on the film, made by this fellow called Crank Sturgeon, which is basically a wooden box with a bunch of screws and springs and some metal rods with a contact mic inside of it. And so I was able to use that with a violin bow and a short bow to create different sounds. And then a lot of the contrabass elements were done by Matthew Mirandi, who is a collaborator of mine and one of the two other performers on the score. And basically I had directed him to play above the bridge on the contrabass to create these really squealy sounds. And we were able to get some really, really interesting sounds out of that. And then also he was actually responsible for a lot of the synthesizer processing that happened. There's this sort of undulation that happens, and I wanted to create this. This is a moment where I did want to create a feeling of dread and uncertainty. And it's, you know, it takes place in a long dark tunnel where someone is being chased, where Bjorn is being chased. And I wanted to be able to create that dread in that moment. And so the core elements of that motion, that undulation that's happening, that pulsing that's happening, is actually a recording of a voice of one of the actors that was on set, in which I had done a lot of manipulation of some of the actors' voices, where I had gone on set and prompted them with certain words or phrases that either came out of the script or were came from, you know, concepts of the original film. And then I processed them down in a way into micro sound, and then stretched and manipulated them so you no longer understood them as a human voice and could not understand. They were unintelligible as words. And then they became texture and density. And so I had done this on several elements that you find in the score, but this particular track, Matthew had done that same process with some of that. And then I used a few other elements from the modular synthesizer on top of that to create this very sort of chaotic world. And so that's why I wanted to showcase this track. I know that was a really long
It's okay. It's great to get the insight of kind of what went into creating this, of all the layers and all the effort that goes into making these tracks. So thank you for the explanation. And let's hear it. Here is William Chases Brianna from Candyman. The end of our program, and I'm going to ask you the question I ask of everybody. What was the first album you purchased, and what was the last thing you listened to?
I had a tape of MC Hammer. So, yeah.
I don't remember the first album I purchased. Gosh, I really don't. I remember having a cassette tape of, I think it was like CBS Great Performances of Gustav Holst's The Planets. But I don't think I purchased that. I think that was my father's cassette. I actually really don't know what the first album I purchased was. It would have been a cassette, but I don't know what it was. And the most recent thing I've listened to, actually, it's probably Sam Wayman, who did the score for a lot of the Bill Gunn films in the 70s and the 80s, who's actually Nina Simone's brother. Very recently, there's been a reissue, or not a reissue, it's never been available as an album before very recently. The score to Ganja and Hess. That's probably the most recent thing I've listened to. Either that or Tristram Cary's Trios, which Tristram Cary was one of the designers of the EMS Synthi, AKS synthesizer in the late 60s in London with Peter Zinoviev. And he made an album in I think 1970 called Trios, if I remember correctly. The album came out in 1970. So it's either one of those, either Sam Wayman's score to Ganja and Hess or Tristram Cary's Trios.
And Emily, what was the last thing?
Oh, I know. I've been listening to Hey What, the new Lo album, on repeat. Double Negative was just already like a mind-blowing record, and Hey What is just great. And I've been obsessively listening to it since it came out.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being on the program, Studio Soundtracks, only on DubLab Radio. Our outro music will be a piece from Emily titled Goodbye Dirk from The Forgotten Battle. Thank you so much, both to you, Robert and Emily, for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.